And welcome back to AA Opera Podcast, episode 79. It's good to be back, but you may have noticed there's been a bit of silence so far, because today we've got a little bit of a situation, guys. I'm going to let Avi take it away.
Hello, everybody. I've become Phoebe's sexy voice.
Oh, I love it.
Oh, my God. I don't know what happened.
Sticky shoes.
Sticky
Where
shoes.
Where do you stick on me?
But to be honest, actually, this happened to me for a 3 month long period in 10th grade, which is like year 11 here.
Okay, so you literally had a voice change.
Yeah, my voice broke like a boy.
your balls dropped.
It was awful. I sounded like this. And then at the time, one of the most popular songs on the radio, yes, the radio, was I'm Too Sexy for My Shirt. So what I did, I recorded a song. There's probably on YouTube, on Facebook somewhere. And then it's just me going, I'm too sexy for my voice. Too sexy for my voice.
That's brilliant. Yeah. That is, I mean, you really suit singing that song with that tone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just
nice. Maybe that can be this week's reel. Just you singing. I'm too sexy.
Maybe I'll record it today and just get it up. I feel like it's also really gross. Like, I feel like people who will listen will be like, Avi, shut up. You're hurting yourself. So I'm going to...
I am getting a bit of anxiety here, sitting here right now. I'm like, okay, so just...
I'm going to continue drinking my Lemsip. I'm going to ask you how your week's been, and I'm going to be quiet.
Okay, that sounds like a good plan. I mean, better than yours is what I'm going to start with, because you don't sound very well at all. So in all seriousness... get better soon. My week has been good. I had a singing lesson, which has probably been the highlight of the week. It always is. Really enjoying that. It's just, you know, you come out of a singing lesson or a singing practice and it don't know what it is. You just feel great, don't you?
100%.
So I had that. And it's almost like going to the gym, you know, when the endorphins are running around. That's how I feel. So that was the highlight of my week.
I do think it has to do with your relationship with your teacher, though.
Oh, for sure. And the reality is you're not going to have a great singing practice all of the time. Disclaimer. But I did on Monday. It was a good one. Aside from this, how was the birthday?
Birthday was really great.
And just another disclaimer, you got ill after the celebrations.
Yes. I got ill, I think, by trying to talk to children under a mask in a very echoey room with a bunch of year threes and fours. Did not go my way.
So relatable. So relatable. But what can you do?
But yeah, birthday was great. I would highly recommend the film club that we went to, but I'll tell you that later.
Oh, okay. Save that. That was cool. We'll save that. Let's kick off today's episode.
Yeah.
It is a good one.
100%.
Of course, we are joined by tenor, Tom/Thomas Elwin. and it is a very open and honest chat. We had a lot of fun. So let Tom take it away. Well, Tom, hello, and welcome to AA Opera Podcast. Would you like to start off by just introducing yourself to our listeners?
Hello, my name is Tom, or Thomas Elwin, as you might see in print. But nobody calls me Thomas apart from my family, so please don't. I'm an opera singer. I guess that's my main thing.
You're in the right place.
Yeah.
We would like to ask you a question by going way, way back. What was your first experience with opera?
Okay. When I was a choir boy, somebody in the year above me got cast to be Miles in Turn of the Screw. And it was for the Royal Opera House, but when, in the late 90s, the Opera House was closed because they were basically refurbishing the whole thing. And so it was Royal Opera House at the Barbican, and it was Turn of the Screw, and it was Deborah Warner was the production, and I only remember Ian Bostridge was in it, and we saw the dress rehearsal, and I don't remember much about the singing. I remember being jealous that I wasn't in it as Miles. But apart from that, opera was just a really foreign thing for me. I just didn't know anything about it.
Yeah. It's interesting because you would think as a choir boy, it would like go hand in hand, especially because you're not the first generation choir boy in your family.
No, it's true. A few boys over the years from St. Paul's had gone on to do Miles. I did a concert performance of King Priam by Tippett, which is not a good introduction to opera as a 12-year-old. In fact, now I think it's a great piece, but at the time I sang the two lines even, went back to my dressing room, my parents sat through 2 hours of Tippett, and they really are not opera people at all. Even now, they try and sort of dip their toes, but yeah, I didn't really get into opera until much, much later, probably even when I was studying as a singer. Because the aim wasn't really to be an opera singer as such at that point. So yeah, Turn of the Screw was my first experience.
But I mean, we'll get on to how you got into opera.
Yes.
But the next question is a little bit more about your time at St. Paul's Cathedral as a choir boy. What was that like, and how did that affect your development as a musician? And kind of the second question to that, did it lead to you wanting to pursue opera?
In short, no. I would say it in some ways got in the way of wanting to be an opera singer.
Right.
Being a choir boy is a great experience in many ways. St. Paul's is probably one of the most intense places to do it. We would do 7 or 8 services a week and 22 and a half hours of rehearsal on top of that, and school.
Did you go to school at St. Paul's,
St. Paul's and Barnes used to be connected, but it's not anymore. The school is in the Cathedral Gardens. So these days, at the One New Change shopping centre end of the cathedral, that's where the school is.
Yeah,
but it is like a program that's connected. Like, in order to be in the choir, you have to go to that school.
Yes, but not the other way around. So my father was there, and it was only the boys of the choir who were in the school. And now there are 160 pupils, and it goes from pre-prep through. So for people who don't know what that is, from year reception or year, I guess you'd
it's
be...
It's like 5 years old,
years old, up to 13. And 36 of those from the age of 7 to 13 are people that are in the choir.
I wonder
boys,
if there's
boys
like...
that are in the choir. There is going to be a girls' choir there, but from a different school.
Interesting. I feel like there must be like a, oh, so you're not in the choir.
So when I was there, it was a very new thing having day boys there, because the choir boys are in the boarding school and nobody else boards. So the sort of the balance of how much the choir was important or not wasn't quite sorted in the 90s. So actually, my time there was probably more intense than they would have now. In terms of musical education, it's incredible. But I don't think knowing how to sight read is helpful to be an opera singer. In our music classes, we were doing university first year level harmony and theory stuff when I was 11 and 12.
That's crazy.
Wow.
So then senior school after that, no music lesson was a challenge.
Yeah.
Which is not ideal to go through senior school thinking everything's a DOS. and also, being able to sight read and pick up music quickly is a great skill if you're within being a choral singer or orchestral musician in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, and I'll probably talk about this later, when I got to Germany, I'd go for a coaching and we'd go through it and I'd sing all the right notes and they go, well, you know it then. So, well, no, you gave me the score this morning. How do I know it? I'm here to work on it.
Yeah.
And then actually memorising is more difficult if you have a very good short-term reading ability.
Interesting.
So trying to flip it. So I'm trying to forget how to read music so that I can.
I mean, that's a quote for the Instagram feed, is that I'm trying to forget how to read
music. I'm trying to forget how to read music.
Yeah.
So then how did that affect your decision to pursue opera?
So the opera decision was because when I did university as a choral scholar a place called Royal Holloway. And then I was working at a professional level as a choral singer with lots of groups that you'd have heard of, people like the Gabrielli Consort and Voces H, who I helped found. And gradually, I found that my voice didn't really suit that situation. And I found it sort of restricted by that. And actually, technically, I probably wasn't singing very well anyway, but I didn't feel something was quite right. So then I went to study. And just before I started studying, I did Hampstead Garden Opera, Le Lisier. I did the role of Nemorino, which was mad at that point. But I did it, and I thought, oh, no, this feels sort of freeing and like a release for my voice to do something different, and this is possibly where it should be. And that sort of started the journey to now. I'm constantly deciding and discovering where my voice should be. But that was really the sort of open door to walk in for opera.
Excellent. So then after Hampstead Garden Opera, you went on to the one and only Royal Academy of Music and were in the opera school. And together with another member of this season, Ross, are famously in the canteen and everyone can see you all the time. Laughing your faces off.
Yeah. That, as I said to him the other day, that joke can't be repeated, unfortunately.
But, and then after that you went to Stuttgart. How did you find the change of studying in the UK versus Germany?
It's different in many ways. And each young artist program is quite different. So some of them are quite heavily coaching and preparation based. And Stuttgart, at the time I was in it, was very much sort of young apprentices in the opera company based. So we did have some coaching and some masterclasses through the year, but a tiny amount compared to somewhere like Zurich or Covent Garden. And within the first month, I think I'd performed in three different operas, in German with a Bavarian accent, Italian, and just about to be one in Russian. So, and crazy. Rehearsals in Russian or German or English often. So it felt like I just went straight into work, but it was with a young artist tag. What I really found was that opera in the UK, I thought, oh, opera in the UK, I'd done chorus at Garsington Opera, and by that point, Glyndebourne as well. And I thought I sort of knew the opera market, but in the UK, not insulting the opera market in the UK, we sort of dip our toe in doing opera. And in Germany, Germany's got a population of something like 80 million, a bit bigger than the UK, but they have 10 times the amount of opera companies, if not more. So for them, opera is part of their culture and society. So opera is done at just another level. It's like you can have very good sports teams. Let's say you have, if the NFL opened a team in London, which it might do one day.
Who knows? I'd watch that.
Yeah, you'd watch it. I would watch it as well. So it would be good, but it would still be part of, like, North America is still the base of NFL. With soccer, football, the Premier League in Europe is sort of where you'd be for football. And the MLS in America, they try, but it sort of feels like the UK is a bit like MLS doing really good football, but it's not quite Germany in opera.
Interesting. I found that very interesting, because especially when people still travel to the UK, obviously not throwing shade on what's going on here, but it's just interesting to think of it as still a small fish in the big pond, rather than a big fish in
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I look at, so I was in Stuttgart, and Stuttgart is the state opera house of Baden-Württemberg. And they do something like 150 performances a year of opera, maybe 120, over the season of maybe 12, 15 operas. Now, English National Opera is sort of the state opera company, and Covent Garden. Those are the two main ones. English National Opera this season will do 50-odd, 55. And theoretically, E&O should be at a higher status than Stuttgart, but actually it's not. In terms of the amount of work they do, it's just such a bigger operation there. And it's just ingrained in the society and culture.
Am I right in thinking as well, if you are a singer, you are kind of employed by the government and you have the whole contracts over there, which we don't have that here.
So the first thing, someone might have spoken about first contracts on this before. So lots of people attached to one opera house are on a salary, and it's a government employment. Some people are freelance, and it's you can be a full-time opera singer much easier over there. Obviously everyone wants to go there, so to maintain that sort of sport comparison, lots of footballers want to go to the Premier League, which is why there are fewer English players in the Premier League percentage-wise than other countries have representation of their own country. And in Germany, loads of opera houses have got lots of foreign singers because it's the sort of the promised land.
The promised land, Well, you've obviously made the decision to return to the UK. What was it that made you make that decision?
At the time in Stuttgart, just timing-wise, I wasn't offered a full-time fest contract. I sort of put on a half-fixed one for a year, and then they hired me for a few guest contracts. And other places were doing that as well. And I moved over there, but without my wife. She was here working, and my family's over here. And at the time, it was easy to go between the two. Obviously, COVID and
The B word.
I don't know which is worse, the C word or the B word.
Obviously they make it a bit more of a challenge. And actually, when the B word was meant to be sorted, I tried to have a sort of English year working for English touring opera, and that's when COVID started. But I would, if the right opportunity came up, I would move there again.
Interesting. Just rewinding a bit for a minute. Before going to Stuttgart, you lost your voice for 6 months, which is probably the most terrifying thing. What was the recovery process like, and did you have a support system? Because I feel like it's impossible to go through that without a support system.
So I lost it for a few reasons, but mainly because I got mugged in London, January 2013. About a week, no, 3 or 4 days before I went to Munich to audition for their Young Artist Programme. And I was just walking from the nearest station to my parents through a park, and I was living at home at the time. And then that first term after that happened, the spring term of 2013, it was my last thing at the Academy, and I was doing Trieke in Onegin, which is not much of a thing. So I didn't really notice, apart from I thought I had a virus sort of developing in March, April. I lost it at the beginning of April, a few days after an awful National Opera Studio audition, which in hindsight, I'm surprised I could make a noise at all. So I lost my voice. When I found out a few months into not being able to sing that it was sort of post-traumatic stress reaction to that, I ended up going to an osteopath. Then he... I'd seen a few years before, and he said that physically it was like I'd been in a car crash. He was surprised I could make a noise at all. And then I suddenly thought, well, what I've learned in the last few years hasn't necessarily prepared me to know what I'm feeling physically as a singer. And that's not the fault of one person specifically, but in hindsight I would have had a teacher who was more physically aware through my studies, and possibly sort of vocal health professionals would talk about how to look after yourself physically, mentally, and just vocally, but they're all of course intertwined. So yeah, it was a physical and emotional reaction that meant I didn't sing, and then I had speech therapy as well and osteopathy and some singing lessons, and by September I was sort of singing okay. So April to September, October was all right. I auditioned in Stuttgart in January. They said, we're not sure. I sang to them again in March and they said, what's happened? How come you're so much better? And I just said, oh, well, this is a 5 month voice. That was a 3 month voice. If you take me, you'll have a year old voice.
Yeah.
And actually it sort of felt like it's been improving ever since then, which is nice.
That's terrifying. It's really interesting that you also had PTSD that affected your voice, something that people don't talk about vocal injury very often in this. But even to think, it doesn't necessarily mean that you were singing wrong. It was just that something happened and it affected that.
Yeah, and what I'd be careful with for people that are affected emotionally, that I went to ENT, ear, nose, throat surgeon, expert in London, somebody that the Royal Academy recommended. I went to a different one that Glyndebourne has recommended. Meanwhile, I was spending all the money I'd earned just seeing these people. And both of them looked down and said, oh, it looks fine. The GP had said they can't see anything wrong. So then I knew something wasn't happening and wasn't right. And everyone who I thought would be able to tell me what was wrong couldn't see anything, which ended up not really helping at all. So then when I went to the osteopath, and that was such a relief, sort of, oh no, you're physically really badly affected by it. And then since then, I did a vocal health first aid course recently, and you discover things like 90% of sore throats are not virus, but are muscle tension related.
Where did you do this? Now I want to do this. I'm like, really interested.
There's a, I can't remember names now, but a lady called Ginevra Williams, who taught me when I was a choir boy, was part of setting up a company called the Vocal Health Clinic, possibly. And they run a vocal health first aid thing you can do. And it just, for me, helped solidify some of the stuff I'd learned when I lost my voice, but also taught me other things. Because actually, yes, I did have a support network. My teacher at the time and the osteopath I have since been to a number of times, about my speech therapist, obviously my wife and my family, and my friends, the ones who I could talk to about it, but also felt very lonely. And as a singer, as a freelance singer, we look after ourselves, and people can try and help, but actually we have to really be careful, particularly when you're going between countries and contracts and all that. We have to be as aware as possible of our physical and mental vocal health, so I thought it was important to do that.
I agree with you. That is definitely something that people don't talk about at all.
Such an important thing to share.
First aid, especially.
Definitely. So we're going to talk a bit now about your freelance career. And you've done a lot of opera work, but you've also done a lot of concert work. What do you find more freeing? Is it being on the concert stage or the operatic stage?
I think there are similarities. I think the variation, they do contrast a lot, depending on what sort of contract it is. So, for example, I mentioned I'm stepping in to do some concerts on Wednesday, quite last minute, and
I can mention it here because this is going up in February, so...
Yeah. I mean, people will have... Well, most of you will have been there, of course, but... so, yeah, I'm doing Messiah on Wednesday in the Royal Albert Hall. We rehearse today and tomorrow. Now, most concerts in the UK, you rehearse on the day. And I find that partly freeing because in the concert, you sort of do what you want within the confines of the conductor's sort of confidence or... or lack of confidence. In Germany, and I've done concerts on the continent, you tend to get a lot more rehearsal. So that gives you a freedom because you've got the confidence that you're sort of, you know each other better. Now, opera, I always said when I first did opera that it's so much better because you rehearse for 6 weeks and then you have the structure of the piece and then you can sort of play with it.
Yeah.
I think that's true. Again, in the continent, often if you do a revival, you have 3 days or a week of rehearsals, and then you're living within the structure of someone else's portrayal of that role, and in a production that you don't know or understand as well, and that can be difficult. What I would say is I love doing both.
Okay. It's interesting that you say about it depends what kind of production it is, because once again, it's like when you're fitting into someone else's shoes, then you don't feel as comfortable. Whereas with a concert, it's always going to be you. It's always going to be your voice and what the conductor wants.
I've done quite a few what they call jump-ins, sort of last-minute step in to do concerts and opera.
And to Christmas.
Yeah.
Sorry. Their brain doesn't...
and I enjoy that. I enjoy the sort of... the the exciting buzz around the energy other people have for that, because they're not quite sure. And partly, actually, my sort of chorister training, I just pick it up quickly and jump in and do it. Mm. And I, 99 times out of 100, I say yes. Mm. Even I did a concert of Dies Natalis by Finzi with the BBC Concert Orchestra on the radio, and they asked 3 days before, and I thought I knew the piece, so I said yes, and I got it, and I didn't know it as well as I'd thought, and so then I sort of madly learnt it, got a coach, and went to a different place near here to learn it, and had rehearsals with the orchestra, and it was exciting and thrilling, and the music was amazing. Mm-hmm. I enjoy that sort of jumping thing.
It is a skill, though, like obviously having that background of being able to. Yeah. That's a real skill I'm jealous of.
Which brings us really well into our next question. Since we know you outside of the podcast, especially me, because we've known each other for almost 4 years now, which is a bit crazy. And I love the when you did your concert recently and I sang in it, you mentioned how you sat in front of the British Museum and spoke to me on the phone for the first time. But we also know that you do a lot of jump-in work, and you were covering at E&O recently, and which you would have been amazing at that role, by the way. I can totally see you singing.
Thank you.
But a lot of people also, this is one of those things that aren't talked to you about when you're studying, is the importance of a cover. What is the role of a cover? How does one prepare for a cover? And how do you even get a role of a cover and jumping in, and what do you need to know, and how do you make the most of that?
Yeah,
I have a lot of questions.
Tell us more, because we don't know.
Yeah, it depends. It's difficult. So my first cover at E&O was when I just came back from Germany. I had an agent, and I'd done some opera Mozart roles in the continent, and they needed a cover quite last minute for Don Ottavio in Don Giovanni. And I wasn't so keen on doing the cover thing, because some people can get stuck covering, and obviously I want to be on stage. But I did step in and do that with sort of 4 hours notice, and it went well, and did it 2 days later, and that was great. But what I found useful for me and for my colleagues, having spoken to them about it, was that the sort of importance of being a good cover is being a good team member, like in any part of life, and knowing how to slot in and not let your stuff affect the team too much. So I now know, if I jump in for something, I know what I want to find out, like how I get on stage, how I get off stage, the real vital places I need to be on stage for other people, not to mess them up, and then within that I can sort of do my own show just to make sure I can do it well. How you become a cover? Well, I covered as a young artist, so that was a young artist thing. All young artists at opera houses around the world, and there are more and more young artist programs because various reasons, they cover. And some people see covering as a really good way into a new company. So I covered at E&O, then their casting department changed, and then I covered again at E&O with their new casting department, quite last minute, and then this time was quite last minute again. And it actually, for me, it's a nice way for them to get to know me, if it's the right music. And it's not a hugely stressful period, unless you go there wanting to completely use it as a chance to show off your potential for work, because actually covers are the least important people in the building until they're needed, then the most important. So it's a weird psychological place to be, because you have to hide in the theatre, and you have to sort of not be seen. It's like being at a Victorian boarding school. So there you are, not being seen, sort of noting everything, trying to make sure that you'd be ready, and hopefully you're not used, because you don't want someone to be sick. And I was not used this time, and that's fine. And I'm looking forward to the spring when I will be used, because I'm not covering. I'm doing all the roles I can.
Incredible. What are you doing in the spring?
I'm doing La Boheme with English Touring Opera.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
As Rodolfo.
I heard you sing.
You did. Yeah, yeah.
That was very beautiful.
Thank you. And I'm doing a role called Gvidon in Rimsky-Korsakov's The Golden Cockerel, who dies, and he's a sort of character role, And I'm also doing the John Passion as one of the evangelists, and it sort of, in order to do the Bohème, I had to do the others. And I'm sure I'll enjoy the others, but I'm basically there because I want to do the Bohème.
Yeah. I just have a question. With COVID being the way it is, does then the role of a cover become a lot more serious in the world that we are today, or is it still pretty much the same?
No. Yes, it is important. So the last show of Pinafore at English National Opera, there were two COVID cases in the cast, and so those two covers went on. So I think just the odds are that there's a higher chance you're going to get on during COVID. And even though there were 19 shows, I didn't get on. So
yeah,
it's not a guaranteed thing.
But then when you're covering, you need to know the role. You basically prepare the role as if you're going to be on.
Yeah.
And then does the opera house help you out in any way, or is it because you're a cover, you're a lot, like, it's all on you?
There are rehearsals. Most opera companies, you are prepared by the time it's opening night. At E&O, it's slightly delayed, so you'd be able to sing from the side for the first few shows, but there's a cover run of the show about a week after the opening night.
Mm.
So you have 2 or 3 weeks of rehearsals.
As you've just said, when talking about covering a role, you're not one to say no to an idea or an opportunity. And we want to talk to you now about side projects. And for those who don't know you, you are the man behind the camera of the former YouTube channel, The Opera Show, as well as the blogger from So You Want to Be an Opera Singer. And you've also been involved with creating the Voces Aid Centre. What have you learned most from doing all of these side projects?
What I've learned most is that I want to be a singer.
Yes.
not to say that side projects aren't important. With the YouTube channel, that sort of came out of the blog. So I did, when I first got to Stuttgart, I realised that nobody in England had really told me much about being a young artist. So I wanted to share my experience of being a young artist by writing about it. So I wrote this blog, So You Want to Be an Opera Singer, every Friday for 44 weeks. I think I missed one. And actually I've read it back a tiny bit since, and it's quite a nice journey through my discovery of what opera in Germany is, and living in a different country, and being on stage and doing all those things. But there was a definite sort of end date of that. And then I wanted to continue it in some way, and YouTube was sort of what I engaged with myself. So I wanted a YouTube channel. And then what I sort of found was my idea for a YouTube channel, I didn't have the funds or backing or time to make it into something I wanted. So I did some videos which are interesting and people watch, still watch.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
You have many really interesting characters on there too.
Yeah, and I really didn't want it to be about me. I wanted it to be about the people that create opera.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be a place where a taxi driver who says, oh, I only thought Italians sang opera, can go and find out all the people that make opera and what opera is.
Yeah.
It sort of got to the point where I couldn't really invest more time or money in it. And so I didn't, and I stopped.
Yeah.
And then the pandemic, and it would have been perfect during the pandemic, of course, yeah. But that's hindsight. With the Voces 8 thing, I was a founder member of the group back in 2006. I was at university with one of the still current members who runs the company. And they've become massively successful around the world, North America and Europe and everywhere, in fact. They're my friends, particularly Barney Smith. I wanted to stay in touch with him throughout the last 15 years. And so then recently they started filming a thing called Live from London concerts that they broadcast. And I have been helping with the filming, and I just like to be involved and support them and help. And actually now, 15 years later, I have got experience and knowledge about being an artist that I think can be helpful for them as an organisation. But really, I want to be singing Bohème at the Met. That's my main thing.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you say that, because it's also one of those things that people don't realize how much time and energy go into side projects.
Yeah.
How important they are, because they also teach us a lot about what we want and how to get to where we want to go. But the way that you said that is also very true. Like, it really heightened where you had to get there.
Mm, absolutely. And I think what I struggled with and still struggle with, and the pandemic hasn't helped this, are moments when I'm not needed. I'm not working, not in rehearsals. I love the sort of buzz of rehearsals. And everybody on social media says they love Zits Probe Day. I like that. But then I love the first day on stage, and I love the dress rehearsal, because often it's mostly friends in the audience or people that really support the opera company. And I love doing a run of shows. And that's sort of when I'm at my happiest, when I'm at home between shows and then I'm doing the shows. So then when I find myself in a period of time when I'm not doing that, I guess also because when I was a child, I had 6 years, every day I knew what my focus was,
mm-hmm.
and my worth on this planet was. So then when that sort of disappears, it's a bit of a struggle. And actually, that's something we'll have to work on. I was listening to Radio 4 during the pandemic to a cellist who lost the feeling in his fingers. He couldn't play anymore. And he had to rebalance sort of the structure of what he is as a human. So if you picture a pyramid, it used to be the big bottom was being a cellist. And then who he was as a person was like the cherry on top. And he had to flip that round. And I think all of us, to an extent, when theatres closed,
mm-hmm.
concert halls closed, we had to sort of rebalance. Actually, the fact I'm an opera singer is not the sort of be-all and end-all of who I am as a person.
Yeah.
That's all I'll say about that.
That's so true.
Yeah.
So true.
With that, any other advice for young people starting out in the industry?
Everyone has an opinion, and it's important. Actually, I wrote about this in my blog. It's important to have a team of people who you trust, but also who can challenge you. So, I don't read a lot of self-help books, but people like Brené Brown, I'm a big fan of, and occasionally read sort of business magazines just out of interest.
Mm.
And people talk about how it's important to have in a sort of boardroom level people that aren't there just to say yes to you. And yes, you sound great, or you're doing all the right things. Now, if that's the case, that's really good. But actually, you want to be the best you can be. So having a coach who will say, are you sure what that person said to you to do is right? And it might be right, but to challenge you and support you. And music college in this country particularly is sort of split between people who have been given big scholarships and it's made relatively easy to get through, and people who haven't, who are constantly sort of fighting to be noticed and to get out of the door at the end of it and be walking into a career. So I particularly found it difficult. I was constantly wanting to do the right thing to be noticed. And so being surrounded by yes people is not helpful. That would be my main piece of advice. And also remember that singing at its best is not a technical thing. It's not done by a machine. It's a human interaction. We're telling stories, and people will engage with somebody in any language at all if you sing with truth and sort of honesty connected to your heart and what you mean and telling a story.
That's beautiful. And just to wrap up, what's next for you, and where can people follow you online to see what you're up to?
Yeah, well, next for me, this is in February.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the end of this month or going into next month, I am involved with English Touring Opera for the next 3 or 4 months, singing mainly La Bohème, though I'm doing the fewest performances of that, and also in the Golden Cockerel and the John Passion, which I mentioned before. And then beyond then, hopefully a stage near you. and online, if people are really interested in my ramblings, I'm a bit of a tweeter.
You like a tweet.
Yeah, I do like a tweet. So that's at Tom Elwin. I have a Facebook page that is either dormant or really active, depending on how I feel. And my Instagram is the same. Sometimes, I mean, it's either running occasionally singing or dog related.
You do have a very cute dog.
I have a very cute dog, yeah. And I've got a website that I probably need to update. But mostly, I think because of the way that people engage on Twitter, that's where I tend to do my online stuff. Tweet, tweet.
Thank you so much for coming to join us. This has been amazing to see you in person and again.
Yeah, yeah. Very nice to see you.
It is now time for this week's question. This week's question is, since I'm lower than one right now, what is your favorite tenor aria? Even though I am terrified of clowns, my favorite tenor aria is actually Vesti la Giubba. I think there's something about the, like, dramaticness of it and, like, the arc that he goes through during that.
It's also the, piece. I can't think of the word. Is it, like, juxtaposition? When the irony, maybe, like, that he's dressed as a clown, but it's all, you know, the whole thing in the opera as a whole is like that, but, yeah, it's a good aria.
Yeah, it's a really good dramatic aria. But what about you?
So I'm going to go with the most cliched response that there could possibly be.
Mine was cliché too, though.
I'm going to say Nessun Dorma is my favourite because...
It's a great one.
I mean, I get emotional every time I hear it. And I think that's quite normal, a normal reaction. But there's a lot of association for me with that aria. And also, massive football fan as well. So it only makes sense. It's a banger.
It's a banger. But if you don't follow us on Instagram, which you should, you can also answer your favorite tenor aria down in the comments box below on this Spotify episode. So let us know, what's your favorite tenor aria?
It's time for our know-it-all segment. And today, I'm taking the reins on this one. And I'm going to chat to you a little bit about La Bohème.
Ooh.
Still, you know, I thought what's relating to this episode, and I know Tom is rehearsing very hard for La Bohème with English Touring Opera right now, so that's what I'm going to talk about. I actually found out some facts that I did not know. So La Bohème's premiere was in 1896, and there was a bit of a race to the finish. Did you know this?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. La Bohème is based on a book of scenes by Henri Murger. And unbeknownst to him, Puccini began composing his adaptation simultaneously alongside Leoncavallo's attempt at composing La Bohème as well.
I did know this one.
So yeah. There was two composers going for the premiere. They had a bit of a tiff, and Puccini did bring his to the stage first, and it is considered the superior show based on merit, but surely the head start didn't hurt as well. So that's my first little thing about La Bohème. But then I kept on scouring the web.
There's a lot of information about that opera.
Yeah, there is. But I also, obviously, you know my love for musicals. And I did not know that Rent was largely inspired by La Bohème. I'm not that well versed in the musical Rent, to be fair. I know the soundtrack, but I've never seen it. But now it all makes sense to me, you see? I did not know this.
To be fair, I think the real reason why I fell in love with opera so much was because I was so obsessed with Jonathan Larson and Rent and Tick, Tick, Boom. Not just now, but like I was obsessed.
See, that's where our little age gap coming to the fore there, isn't it?
Yeah. But I was so obsessed that... That's how I discovered La Bohème. And that's kind of what brought me in to the opera world for more like for my personal point of view, not just because I was taken to the opera, but because the story that I had so much loved was actually originally by something else. And then I discovered Miss Saigon.
Yeah.
Moulin Rouge.
Yeah.
La Traviata. And I had another one, but I can't remember right now.
You see, people think that the musicals and Broadway are so far apart from opera, but that's definitely not the case. Go on.
West Side Story, Romeo and Juliet. Juliet,
there you go. There it is.
Which I was also like a Shakespeare nerd.
So my second half of this, Know It All. You probably already do know it all by the sound of it. But I came to find that...
I don't.
There was, well, online it calls it a modernised La Bohème Broadway production of La Bohème in 2002 with Alfie Bull.
I did not know this.
It got... So in 2002, Rent was on Broadway between 1996 and 2008. But in 2002... Aside from the like not in the Met, we're talking it was on a in the Broadway theater, one of them. there was a modernized version of La Bohème, starring Alfie Beau, and I just thought to myself, I wonder what the Met had to say about that. It sounds great, but I just wonder how they got away with that, with the Met being right there as well.
That's a great question.
There we go. That's Know It All.
And that is it for this week's episode. Thank you so much, Tom, for being here. It is always, always, always a pleasure to talk to Tom. But you can follow us on all social media platforms. We are
AA Opera Everywhere. And please remember to rate and subscribe to this podcast. That would really, really help us out. And be sure that you're subscribed to our newsletter as well. And you can do so by via the website. It's aaoperapod.com.
Yes. And don't forget to support us on Patreon. We are patreon.com/AA Opera. You get episodes early and some other perks, which just come over and check it out.
You absolutely should. Follow along, guys, and we look forward to seeing you next week with a brand new episode.
Which we will both be in New York for.
Yeah. See you then, guys. Bye.
Bye.